Okay, we are going to move on to Henderson and Clark and their concept of architectural innovation. This is a somewhat different form of innovation from disruption, like pretty fundamentally different. But like disruption, architectural innovation is going to be something that's very difficult for established actors to deal with. But it's going to be hard for another reason. If we say that disruption is going to be difficult because of the way the firm is going to relate to its customers, right? It's going to be disruption is about addressing these low end of the market, and that makes it difficult for incumbents to pursue. Architectural innovation is going to be difficult not because of something external to the firm, but because of the firm itself, because of the organization itself. Right? So let's try to take that a little bit in smaller chunks. It can be a little opaque, perhaps, but there are essentially two parts to Henderson and Clark's argument. The first has to do with the effects that a dominant design has on organizations. And the second has to do with a particular form of innovation, namely architectural innovation. And the way those two ideas kind of relate to each other explains why it is that architectural innovation can be so difficult, right? So here's the argument in really headline form, right? So basically, an organization structure and workflow is going to reflect the architecture of its product, the dominant design, so to speak. How are things put together, right? Some innovations, however, are going to be architectural in the sense that they don't change the components of a product very much, but they change how the components are put together, how they are related to each other, right? Architectural innovation is going to be hard to deal with, and it's going to be particularly hard to predict for companies that have built up structures and processes that reflect the old product, the old product architecture, because the new innovations cannot be effectively managed within the framework of old structures, right? So the idea here is that a product has an architecture in that a product consists of a number of components that are put together in a particular way, right? The product kind of ends up being a coherent system consisting of a number of distinct subsystems and components, right? Henderson and Clark kind of use the example of a ceiling-mounted fan, right? A fan is a system, a total system consisting of a number of components, right? There's going to be an electric motor, some rotor blades. There's going to be some kind of a box around the engine, and that's all going to be put together in a particular way. That way of putting things together is a product architecture, and it typically reflects a dominant design. That design might not be settled if the industry is in an era of ferment. In that case, there might be a variety of designs, each with their own architecture. But once you kind of move into an era of incremental change, there'll often be one or two dominant designs, and most organizations are going to kind of adopt one of those, right? When you think about this, right, that there are components and there are product architectures, it becomes obvious that in order to design a well-functioning product, the organization has to possess two kinds of knowledge, right? It has to know something about the individual components and has to know something about how to put them together. That's component knowledge and architectural knowledge in Henderson and Clark's terms, right? Those forms of knowledge, those two forms, come to shape the organization. We can understand this kind of with Abernathy in that organizations go from fluid to specific over time, especially when a dominant design occurs. Basically, what Henderson and Clark are going to argue is that as an organization moves towards increasing specificity, it's going to take on more and more of the form. It's going to mirror much more closely the architecture of its product, right? So two things start to happen when organizations have a dominant design to orient themselves after, right? One thing is that they stop exploring alternative product architectures and alternative designs, right? That's immediately understandable through Marx's concepts, right? Exploring alternatives is an explorative activity, which in the short run is less profitable than exploiting within the framework of the design you have, right? The other thing is that with a particular design, there are routines are going to arise about how the organization works, right? Think of car production here. A general problem, how do we transfer power to the wheels from the engine? We do that through a gearbox and the cardan shaft. And as the organization kind of grows into dealing with that problem in more and more fixed ways, they're going to have more and more fixed communication channels, such that the people who develop engines primarily talk to those who develop gearboxes, who then talk to those people who develop the cardan axles, who then talk to the people who develop the wheels, right? Basically, the communication channels of the organization are going to mirror the significant interfaces between components, which groups work with, right? It's not particularly necessary for the engine people to talk to the wheel people, right? Because that there's no real interface there. I don't know anything about car production, so this is a made-up example, right? But basically, in order for communication to happen fluently and efficiently, as you would expect in kind of a specified organization, people are going to start communicating around the interfaces where the components that they work with have particular problems, and they're going to solve those problems in kind of established ways, right? Routines over time start to settle in. On the one hand, you're just going to have personal relationships building up, right? Jimmy from the engine department is going to talk to Karina from the cardan axle office more often than he talks to Joe from the wheel office. So informal communication patterns are just going to emerge and get easier and easier over time. People know who to call for an informal conversation, whereas they're going to be writing more official emails to get to that other person that they don't know. And that just means that information flows in ways that kind of mirror the product architecture, right? The organization structure itself is also going to begin to reflect the product architecture, right? So if an organization wants to be effective, it's going to often build its departments around the significant components, because that makes it easier for people to specialize. And one of the base insights of economics is that specialization is the key to efficiency, right? So in the short run, you're going to be more efficient if you're more specialized and better able to exploit the knowledge that you have. Whereas if you want to keep a very broad mind, where you want to keep the organization very fluid, then that's going to be compromised. It's going to be more difficult for people to specialize and to talk only to the people who are specialized with them, right? The very effective organization is also going to be one that formalizes the interaction between departments in a particular way, so that there's less waste of time and resources, right? There's no reason for people scattered across the organization to meet when really what you're trying to solve is a particular problem at one particular interface between two components, right? That means you're rarely going to take that systems level view and open up the discussion of, is our product architecture really optimal, right? So in that way, you can say that the organization structure, both at the formal and informal level, are going to end up reflecting product architecture through the definition of communication channels, through the definition of communication filters, right? Who gets to know what, and the strategies for problem solving. Right? The more you work with a given design, with a given product architecture, the more locked in these things become. Right? So that's setting up the problem, right? And then architectural innovation happens. Now, let's start off talking about what that is, right? So an architectural innovation is an innovation that does not change the components that a product consists of. It changes only the way that they're put together. Right, so in Henderson and Clark's words, I'm going to quote now, innovations that change the way in which the components of a product are linked together while leaving the core design concepts untouched. So basically, if we... There's nothing here in the sense of incremental innovations, right? What you would normally identify as a product innovation, whether radical or incremental, is not there, right? the components remain the same. There's no significant shift in that, but there is a shift in how they are put together. So if we just exemplify that, right? If you use the fan example from before, it's not an incremental innovation in the sense that an incremental innovation would be an improvement in one component, right? You might have a slightly better engine, slightly better rotor blades for the fan that mean that the air gets distributed faster, right? It's also not going to be a radical innovation in the sense that we would have this entirely new, that we would expect like a jump to a new S-curve, right? You could say, talk about the jump from fans to air conditioning. That's not what's happening. Basically, you're just having the same components, putting them together in a new way, right? Kind of a popular example of that. Many of you will know the GoPro action camera. Basically, a GoPro doesn't really consist of any components that didn't already exist and were pretty well understood in digital photography and video, right? So the lenses, the picture chips, the memory cards, the waterproof cases, all the things that kind of come together in a GoPro are pretty well known, right? But the way that GoPro puts those things together in creating the action camera as a category was fundamentally new by being a new product architecture based on old components put together in a new way. You can kind of read more about this if you also look at Sony's serial architectural innovation about around the Sony Walkman. There's a great paper on that called Managing Product Families, the Case of the Sony Walkman by Susan Sanderson and Mustafa Uzumeri. It's from 1995 and it's published in Research Policy. That kind of gives you a nice sense of how the Walkman changed through consecutive architectural innovations rather than in radical or incremental ways. Okay, so why is it that this particular kind of change, this particular kind of innovation is so difficult for established companies to deal with? Well, firstly, it's going to be difficult to anticipate architectural innovation, right? Unlike technological discontinuities, where there's going to be some kind of a performance ceiling and a new S-curve, you can kind of see that as new technologies emerge. Do they have some potential to improve? How do they relate to others? What kind of investment is going to be necessary to drive forward an S-curve, things like that. There's not really very much technological development in an architectural innovation. It's just, right, just in quotes, it's just about putting things together in a new way, right? So there's a need, basically what you see is there's a reconfiguration that's not obvious when looking at an S-curve or when trying to extrapolate the future of one. It's much more in continuation of Shane's way of thinking. It's about seeing an alternative possibility in an existing set of technologies. And that opportunity being something that you can realize through putting the technologies together in a new way, right? The second part, and this is really the kicker in Henderson and Clark's argument, switching from one product architecture to another can be extremely inefficient and extremely difficult for an established company because dealing with that innovation is going to be a matter of organizational change, right? So you can have complete control over the routines and processes from developing digital photography devices, right? Digital cameras. But having an action camera can require a whole new way of thinking that can require a whole new way of working and a whole new way of organizing, a whole new set of relationships and communication filters that you need to have the organization function. It basically, right, architectural innovation can basically make the architectural knowledge that the company has built up and excelled in superfluous, right? As a matter of fact, it can be a little bit like what Christensen describes in relation to markets, right? That the capabilities that you have for serving a high-level market can be a disability when serving low-end ones. In the same way, that knowledge that you have of existing product architectures can become a disability as you're trying to deal with new kind of organizational routines and cultures and communication channels that would be necessary to deal with an architectural innovation, right? So if we're going to use Foster's concept of the attacker's advantage, there can be a real advantage for an attacker doing architectural innovation because they're not going to have an established organization that acts as a deadweight as they try to pursue a new architecture, right? So suddenly incumbency is going to, being an established company, is going to imply that you already have a particular organizational architecture in place that can actually slow you down as you try to pursue new opportunities, new architectural innovations, right? Okay. So in that sense, there's a resemblance between disruptive innovation, architectural innovation, and the kind of challenge that they pose, right? Both make a capability into a disability. Both can have pretty deep level consequences, but they have those effects and those consequences on different grounds, right? Basically, instead of being a market directed thing, as was the case with disruptive innovation, architectural innovation is all about internal processes and internal issues that have to be resolved in order to deal with these architectural changes, right? So one way to think about what this article also does is that it provides an extension of our ability to classify innovations, right? That's kind of a big contribution of both disruptive and architectural innovation. You can remember that Schumpeter talked about new products, processes, organizational forms, and markets, right? Henderson and Clark are going to give us some more nuance to that by firstly giving us a distinction between components and systems, right? Sometimes all the action within an industry is not going to be at the level of products or processes, but rather it's going to be at the component level, right? Sometimes what you're going to see is at the system level, there's going to be dramatic change, but many times what actually ends up happening is that a subcomponent that influences either the product design or the process design is going to be the things that are really driving change, right? So it's going to be worth that's going to be worth paying attention to when we try to understand specific innovation processes and industry dynamics. We're going to get into some detail on that as we look at the Vincenti paper a little bit later. Now, the other distinction that Henderson and Clark give us is one that's widely used in innovation studies, and this is the distinction between radical and incremental, right? Christensen gave us this distinction between sustaining and disruptive, and which is different, right? Within the same kind of sustaining innovation way of thinking, you can have both radical and incremental change. And the radical incremental distinction is one that we'll encounter again and again, just like we will we'll be returning to the idea of the disruptive and the sustaining, right? So in short, we get some nuance, which is important because radical incremental innovation are going to require different inputs. They're going to have different effects, and when you look at research papers, it's important to distinguish between what people are talking about, because implicitly they will often be describing one or the other, right? So that kind of nuance is going to be especially helpful as we talk about the organizing of innovation within organizations. Right? That's going to be kind of an implicit distinction between the radical and the incremental. That's going to help you make sense of how you reconcile some different findings. We'll get back to that. Okay, but basically, if you want some clarity on this concept, I suggest that you look at Henderson and Clark's Figure 1, basically the way that they articulate it is the following. Right? Framed in this way, i.e. that there's a difference between components and product architectures, radical and incremental innovation can be extreme points along both dimensions. By both dimensions, I mean the novelty of components and the novelty of connection between components. I'm going to quote again, right? Radical innovation establishes a new dominant design and hence a new set of core design concepts embodied in components that are linked together in a new architecture. Incremental innovation refines and extends an established design. Improvements occur in individual components, but the underlying core concepts underlying this core design concepts, and the links between them remain the same. Right? But you can see that as you have those polar opposites, there is space in between for this kind of architectural innovation, right? That's what they add to the typology when they talk about modular and architectural innovations, right? We already kind of talked about what architectural innovations are, right? And the modular innovation, modular being something that we're going to return to in as we talk about the future of innovation management. A modular innovation is an innovation that changes only the core design concepts of a technology, right? So they provide an example. To the degree that one can simply replace an analog dialing device with a digital one, it's an innovation that changes a core design concept without changing the product architecture, right? So in the sense that you can change just one component, that's going to turn out, this idea of modularization is going to turn out to be pretty important as we talk about the future of technology. But basically, you want to think about these four different forms, right? Radical and incremental being polar examples of either for radical innovation, total change in both design concepts and components. For incremental, it's going to be minor changes only in components or slight tweaks. But in between, you're going to have these things where you have either wholesale change in components, but no change in architecture, or, as is the case for architectural innovation, very little change in components, but pretty dramatic change in architectures, right? Okay, so that I think we're going to leave this paper behind, and we'll move on to David's paper on the dynamo and the computer, and we're going to be discussing general purpose technologies, sometimes called foundational technologies, with that. Okay, and that's all for now.